One of the lenses through which one can view characters in Tanakh is the lens of genealogy. In the eyes of Tanakh, an individual is not just an individual. An individual is a member of a family over the generations. We all know from life that certain families have certain traits, you know, families that we know, our own families, have certain traits that tend to run through different characters of the family. But Tanakh takes it one step further. In the eyes of Tanakh, those traits are so intrinsic that they even span the generations. It's not about different members of a nuclear family who all hold a particular value to be important, but rather we can actually see characters over the generations in Tanakh as members of a family tree. And helping and understanding their genealogy and their lineage actually sheds light on understanding who they are. One of my favorite examples of this is the example of Korach and Shmuel. Korach is Shmuel is a descendant of Korach, and I think that we can see some similarities between the two of them that really shed light on the way that this whole paradigm works in Tanakh in general. In fact, the Haftarah from Parshat Korach is from Parakim Yud Aleph Yud Bet of Shmuel Aleph, and sheds light on the way that this mechanism works. So the first source on your sheet is from Parshat Korach, where Korach stands up against Moshe and Aaron and expresses his complaints against them. In Pasuk Gimel, the Nesi'im and Korach express their complaint that Moshe has taken the spiritual leadership and given it just to his brother. And they say, "Kikol ha'edah kulam kedoshim u'betocham Hashem, u'madu atitnasu al tehal Hashem." And later in Pasuk Yud Gimel, the Datan and Aviram, who are also allied with Korach, express their complaint against the political leadership, what they view as Moshe's political ineptitude, in that they say, "Hamat ki halitanu meret v'zabat chalab udvash, lahamitinu b'memar ki tisdarer alenu gan hisdarer." That, like, is it not enough that you've taken us from a land of milk and honey, obviously referring to Mitzrayim, and sort of throwing Moshe's words back in his face as saying, you said you were going to bring us to a land of milk and honey, but in fact what you did was you took us out of a land of milk and honey, and you're killing us off in the Midbar. And Moshe's response to this be very hurt. In Pasuk Tedva, Vayichar l'Moshe ma'od. Vayichar here, it doesn't say Vayichar af. Rashi explains it as nitzta'er, that he felt very hurt. And he says to Hashem, "Al tifen al minchatam, lo chamor echad mehem nasati, v'lo harayoti et echad mehem." Don't listen to their tefillot. I was not a corrupt leader. What they're saying is not true. I never took one donkey that didn't belong to me. Now, Shmuel, the next selection is from Shmuel Aleph, Parakim Yud Aleph to Yud Bet, which is, as I said, is the Haftarah for that Parsha. And clearly, Chazal intended for us, the reason that this is the Haftarah is obviously so that we can read them and compare them to each other. Shmuel is known the same, while Shmuel is obviously on the opposite end of the moral spectrum from Korach, there are certain commonalities between them. What Korach's complaint is that Moshe has centralized authority in a few people in a way that's unfair. And they have a suspicion about the way that he has delegated both spiritual and political authority. Shmuel, as well, is known as being the ultimate anti-establishment Navi. He is very critical of centralized authority in a number of ways. He rails against the corruption of B'nai Eli. He is extremely suspicious of the institution of the monarchy. He's only too happy to let Shaul know that he has messed up in his role as monarch. He's suspicious throughout of any type of centralized human authority. And in fact, we see there's a very poignant parallel to Korach in Pasuk Gimel of Shmuel Aleph and Parak Yud Bet, where he says, "Hinini anuvi." This is in the part of Parak where he is being mechadesh the malucha for Shaul. And in that context, he says, "Et shur mi lakachti, v'chamor mi lakachti, v'et mi ashakti, et mi ratzoti." He's echoing Moshe's words, saying, when the people ask for a monarch, he's saying, "Why are you turning against me as the Navi Hashem? I've never dealt corruptly with you. Why are you being so suspicious of my authority?" And what's so interesting is that on the one hand, we see Korach as embodying the same trait as, I'm sorry, we see Shmuel as embodying the same trait as Korach, and that he has the suspicion of delegating authority to just a few individuals. On the other hand, he's the opposite of Korach, and that the one authority that he does trust is the Navi Hashem, which was who Korach rebelled against in the form of Moshe and Aaron, specifically Moshe. So he's sort of both at the same time. He has that mitzvah of Korach, of questioning human authority. At the same time, the one authority he does trust is the authority that's embodied by Moshe, against whom Korach was rebelling. So what I think is interesting is that as he's expressing this mitzvah of Korach in questioning the monarchy, he uses Moshe's words. So I feel like the Tanakh is sort of combining them, he's sort of both at the same time. He has this one fundamental mitzvah of Korach, and yet he's expressing it with Moshe's words to indicate that he's not morally on Korach's side at all. He's on Moshe's side. But at the same time, he's being informed by that fundamental mistrust of giving too much authority to one human being. I like this example a lot because it indicates the way that traits carry through families in Tanakh, that the same trait can come up many times in different generations and yet take different colorations and different moral overtones depending on the context and the individual. So that's actually not the family tree I'm going to focus on today. I just wanted to give that by way of example. But today we're going to focus on the family tree of Rachel and Leah, because first of all, you can really see almost all of Tanakh as the playing out of the midot of Rachel and Leah, and particularly it lends insight into the Yeshua of Purim. The next source on your sheet is from Bereishis Rabbah. It's a story that maybe you've heard before, but I'd like to read it inside. Vayasof Lavan et kol anshei hamakom, vayas mishteh. Kineis kol anshei mekomo amar lahem, yodim atem shayinu duchukim lamayim, v'kevan shebah hatzadik hazeh lekan et barchu hamayim. So Lavan gathered together all the people of his place, and he made a feast. He got all of the people together, and he said, you know that we needed water. And when this tzaddik, Yaakov, came here, the water was blessed. Amr le'yuma hanilach. So they said, what do you want to do? How can we help you? Amar lahon in bayanatun anamarame bay, v'yahav le'leya, duhu rachum lahada rachal sagi, v'hu avadach agav chon shiva shninach ochrin. So he says, if you want, I'm going to give him Leah, because he loves Rachel very much, and he'll work here another 7 years in order to get Rachel. Amrin le avin madahani lach. So he said, okay, fine, do whatever you want. Amar lehun havlu mashkin delet chad min chon mefarsim, v'yavlu ni mashkonin, v'azol v'aiti aleihin chamar mashach of kufar, havi lama nikrashmo levan ha'arami shirima ba'anshe mekomo. So he said, you each have to give me a mashkon to some kind of collateral so that I know that none of you is going to go and publicize this, or let anyone know that I'm going to do this trick. So they did, and he used those mashkonim to buy supplies to buy wine and oil and meat for the wedding. And that's why he's called Lavan Ha'arami, because even in context where it's obvious that he's from Aram, he's still called Lavan Ha'arami to show that he rimad be'anshe mekomo, that he tricked the people of his place, meaning that he was even more deceptive than your average Arami. V'kule yoma habu mechalon bei v'kevan da albaram she'amar lahon ma'hu kadein. Amrin lei at gamal t'chesed b'schutecha v'hayu mekalsin kon ma v'amrin halia'a. So all day they were like praising, they were like dancing in front of Yaakov and praising him. And when it got to be evening, he said, what's going on? Why are you doing this for so long? And they said, you did a chesed for us. And so they kept praising in front of him and saying, halia'a, halia'a. This one is for, this one meaning Leah, or, you know, he thinks it's Rachel. This woman is for the ya'ah, is for this fine man. And they were trying to hint to him, he Leah, he Leah. Halia'a, halia'a, he Leah, he Leah. Baram sha'atun ma'atza v'chavun butinaya, amar lahun ma'hu kadein, amri le ma'atza v'ort anan zichrin kevavchun. So at night they came, the people who were bringing the bride in came and they extinguished the lights. So he said, what are you doing? And they said, do you think we're immodest like you are? You know, we prefer to extinguish the lights. And all that night he called her Rachel, and she answered him. In the morning he saw that it was Leah. Amar la ma ramaita bat rama'a, la v'leil yahava karena Rachel va'at anitale. And so he said, what, you're such a deceiver, the daughter of a deceiver. In the night didn't I call you Rachel and you answered me? Amrale, it safar delate le talmidim, lo kach yatsavach lachavuch esav vat anile. So she says something interesting. She says, literally what this means is there a barber who has no students? So the way that the Mefarshim generally understand this is that you can't cut your own hair. So a barber needs to train other people or to rely on other people to cut his hair for him. So she's saying that just like you did this to your father, and you called, your father called you Esav and you answered him, so now you're getting, it's coming back to you, right? I'm, now your hair is being cut. And Vayomer Alav and Mazot Asita Li Vigomer, Vayomer Alav and Lo Yaseachin Bim Komeinu, etc. Okay, so I think what Chazal are trying to tell us with this midrash, the way that they see the personality of Leah, it's very interesting to compare the way Leah reacts to Yaakov's accusation versus the way that Lavan reacts. Lavan gives an answer. When he says to her, "Why, Lama Rimitani, why did you do this to me?" Lavan says, "Because we don't do this in our place. We never marry off the younger before the older." He has a rationalization. Why was this an okay thing to do? Leah doesn't try to do that. Leah doesn't say there was a reason why this was okay. She just says, "Listen, let's not play games here. We know, you know and I know, that there are times in life when you have to do something that you don't really want to do. You didn't want to go trick your father, and I didn't want to trick you." She doesn't try to really excuse her behavior. She just says, she's unapologetic. She says, "Yeah, okay, right, I lied. You know, you weren't crazy about it when you had to do it, and I wasn't crazy about it when I had to do it. But at the same time, you just as you had to choose between two evils, and you chose the lesser of the evils, that's the same thing I did." She's unapologetic, without really trying to give a moral excuse. She's ultimately, Leah is extremely pragmatic. And extremely proactive, assertive, and pragmatic. And I think we see this throughout the story of Leah. For example, the next source is the story of the Judaim, where Reuven goes out and gets Judaim in the first pasuk, and Rachel asks Leah, "Tni li mi Judae b'neich." And so Leah responds, "Vatomer la hamaat kach techadishi v'lakach gan at Judae b'ni." Vatomer Rachel lachin yishgabi machalai latachat Judae b'neich. So Leah says to her, "Is it not enough that you took my husband? Now you want to take my Judaim as well?" So Rachel says, "Fine. So he'll sleep in your tent tonight." And Rachel goes, and Leah goes out and says, "You know, you have to come to my tent tonight." So on the one hand, we see a lot of pain and hurt in this excerpt. That, you know, you can imagine sort of the bitterness of the feelings that were underlying that statement of, "Is it not enough that you took my husband and now you also want to take my Judaim?" But on the other hand, again, Leah is pragmatic. Leah knows that her choice is not between Yaakov loving her and marrying her or Yaakov not loving her and marrying her. Her choice is between Yaakov not loving her and not marrying her or Yaakov not loving her and marrying her. And that being the case, she'll go with him not loving her and marrying her. Meaning she understands, she's unflinching in recognizing her reality and understanding what she has to do within that reality. So while I'm sure that this was not Leah's dream wedding, and it was not, and I'm sure that Leah never wanted to have to sell off Judaim to get her husband to come to her tent that night. At the same time, she's unflinching and confronting the fact that that's what she has to do. It has been argued that Leah's daughter Dina, about whom we know very little, we know only the story of her rape by Shechem, carries on the same trait of assertiveness that we see throughout the Leah story. In the next source on your sheet, before we get to that, the Rashi on Vayishma Elokim El Leah, which is on the story of the Judaim, Rashi says that Leah became pregnant, and that was a reward, shehaita metava u'mechazaret laharbot shvati, meaning that her greatness is the fact that she was willing to go out and sell her Judaim to get her husband to come to her tent that night. In other words, that her reward, her greatness, is due to her ability to take those types of assertive actions. Now, if we go to the next source, which is the story of Dina, Vatetze Dina bat Leah, asher yaldal Yaakov lirot bivnot haaretz. She goes out to see Shechem, to meet the bivnot haaretz in Shechem, and Shechem sees her, vayikach ota v'yishkav ota v'yaneha, he rapes her, vatibak nafsho b'dina, after that he loves her, v'yahavat hanara v'yadaber alev hanara, and he asks his father, and you're all familiar with the story, they approach the family of Yaakov and ask, "What can we do? We want to marry your daughters and have you marry our daughters," and, you know, so they do the bris and then Shimon and Levi kill them. But in any case, it has been argued that Leah in this story, Dina in this story, which is the only story we have of Dina, represents the same midot of Leah. The Lubavitcher Rebbe actually pointed out that in the next source, the Rashi, on this story, Bat Leah, Rashi, the Dibur Machil Bat Leah, Rashi says, "V'lo Bat Yaakov, ela al shem yitziyata nikrit Bat Leah, sha'achi yatanit haita, shenamar batetze Leah likrato." So the Aleha Mashlu HaMashal Ke'ima Kibita. So Rashi says that the reason says that Tzidina bat Leah, why does it identify her as being bat Leah? First of all, we already knew that. And second of all, why doesn't it also say bat Yaakov? So he says because she went out in the same way that her mother went out. Bat Tzidina bat Leah, similar to the way that Leah went out in the previous story that we saw the Duda in, to meet Yaakov. So he says that the reason that's why she's called that's a commonality between them. Now, when he says she is a Yatsanit, Yatsanit does not have a positive implication. Yatsanit makes it sound like Dina was immodest, that this was somehow an inappropriate way of going out. And he may be informed by the fact that ultimately she was raped. Maybe he thinks there was something immodest about the way she was going out. But the Lubavitcher Rebbe actually pointed out that it's very funny that Rashi quotes the story with Leah to back up his point that she was immodest, because by Leah, he thought that was a huge schut. He thought that was the schut of Leah. That's why she got pregnant. That's why Hashem gave her more children. So if he were trying to prove something negative about Dina, then why would he quote as support, and why would he say she's just like her mother in this story, in which I think her mother did something really great? It doesn't make any sense, right? So Lubavitcher's idea was that what he was really saying is that Yatsani, and again, this is not Pshat in Rashi, because Yatsani doesn't sound like a very positive word in Pshat, but his idea was that he was actually saying that Dina's going out was a positive thing, that it indicated that she was an assertive, proactive person who wanted to influence those around her, and that when she went out to see Bibnot Haaretz, she actually wanted to forge ties between the family of Yaakov and the people who lived in Shechem, that she was, if anything, being an emissary of monotheism to the people around her, and that, he argues, ironically, that she actually succeeded in a way, in a sort of twisted way, because afterwards, they do want to actually join the family of Yaakov. I mean, ultimately, of course, it's too late because they already raped her, so, you know, they lost their chance. But at the same time, the fact that it's not like the story of Tamar where she's thrown away after she's raped, but there was some type of strength of character in her that she actually did influence Shechem to want to join the family of Yaakov in some way. Now, they lost their chance, but that is part of his support for this. So it's an interesting idea, actually, because he also says that Leah, in the famous Rashi, where Rashi says that Ve'enei Leah Rakot, that the reason that Leah cried all the time is because everyone said that she would have to marry Esav and Rachel would marry Yaakov. He says that people didn't only say that she would have to marry Esav because she was the oldest and he was the oldest, but that actually, that she would have been a good shidduch, that she was someone who could have handled Esav, who could have somehow turned him to good because of who she was, because of that assertive, proactive ability to influence others, that actually maybe she would have been able to do it, but she didn't want to. Amelia Rapport, she was crying because she didn't want that challenge in life, which is certainly understandable. Whereas Dina actually took it to another level. She welcomed it. She did want that challenge in a way. Of course, she didn't want to be raped, but she did want to interact with the surrounding society. I remember the first time I learned this idea, I learned this sicha of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I was in Israel for the year, and I was learning with a chavrita who had lost her mother as a very young child when she was 3. It was a very big, you know, it was clearly a very big issue psychologically for her throughout her life, that not only had she lost her mother very young, but that since she was the youngest child in the family, she was also the only one who didn't really have memories of her mother. And I remember when we learned the sicha together, it gave her tremendous nechama to think that there might be a connection between her and her mother that didn't depend on conscious memories or experiences, but that there could be a midah that runs through a family and that maybe even later generations take to new heights, that one might not even be conscious existed in one's predecessor, that there could be a bond between them that was deeper than just conscious memory or experience, but that somehow maybe she was even fulfilling certain needs out of her mother without even realizing it. I remember it was really a source of nechama to her. Like to move on, we're going to return to Leah a bit later, but having identified sort of those key midot of Leah being very assertive and proactive and able to influence others and act in her environment, I'd like to turn now to the family of Rachel, which will really be the bulk of what we're looking at today. The next source is the Gemara that I'm sure you're all familiar with this story, but we'll read it together to see how we can develop it. Gemara says, Lo yikra b'tzadak inav. V'schar tzniut shehita ba b'rachel, zachta v'yatza mimenu Sha'ul. V'schar tzniut shehaya bo b'Sha'ul, zachta v'yatza mimenu Esther. So it says in Eov that Hashem doesn't remove his eyes from a tzaddik. Because of the tzniut that Rachel had, she had the zchut of Sha'ul being her descendant. And because of his tzniut, he had the zchut of Esther being his descendant. Umay tzniut haita ba b'Rachel. So what was Rachel's tzniut? Dichtiv ve'yaged Yaakov l'Rachel ki achi abiyahu. That Yaakov told Rachel that he was her father's brother. V'chi achi abiyahu v'halo ben achot abiyahu. That's not really true. He wasn't her father's brother. So why did he say that? Ela amarla min sabali. So she, rather what it means is that he asked Rachel, will you marry me? Amrala in, she said yes. Mihu abba rama'ahu, v'lo yachotle, but my father is deceptive and you won't be able to overcome him. Amrala, achiva na b'rema'ut, I am his brother in deception. Meaning not his biological brother, but I am his brother in being able to deceive. Amrala, umi shari le tzadiki le skuye b'rema'uta. So she said, and is it permitted for a tzadik to deceive? Amrala in, and he brings this pasuk that says that you can act deceptively with a deceptive person. So what is the deception that he'll do? She said, I have an older sister, and he won't let me marry before she does. Masar la simanim, this is the famous story of the simanim, kimata leilya amra hashtam nechsefa achtai, masartin ha nihla. But when it came to be the night of their wedding, she saw that her sister would be embarrassed, so she gave her the simanim. V'haynu dichti v'ayhi baboker v'hinehi leia michlad ad hashta lav leiahi ala mitoch simanim shemasra brachal leia lo haviyada ad hashta. Guys, so that's why it says v'ayhi baboker v'hinehi leia, because he didn't realize that it was leia until the morning, because she had the simanim. V'fichach zachta v'yata mimenu sha'ol. That's why she had this chut of having sha'ol come from her. U'mat tzniut haita b'sha'ol. Dechtiv et dvar hamalucha lo higid lo asher amar Shmuel. What was the tzniut of sha'ol? That he did not tell the dvar hamalucha. He did not tell that he had been made the king. Zachta v'yata b'menu Esther. Okay, we're going to stop there for now. So the Gemara identifies Tzniut as the Midah of Rachel and all of Beit Rachel, and associates her with her descendants Shaul and Esther by virtue of this Midah. So clearly Tzniut in this context has a nuanced, meaning more nuanced than just modesty. It seems from this Gemara that what Tzniut means in the context of Leia is an ability to sort of not show all of one's cards, to be discreet, to keep a secret. The idea is sort of a very strong sense of privacy. And in fact, what stands out about Rachel and all of her descendants in Tanakh is that their identity, what's key about them, lies very deeply within them and only comes out at real moments of crisis and often in ways that are not perceptible by others, that are not in the public eye. So for example, in the Simanim story, Rachel acts with great courage and based on her principles, but in a way that most people will never know about. I mean, we know because we have the Gemara, right? But in her life, she knew, and her sister knew, and ultimately Yaakov knew, and I guess Lava, maybe. Who knows if he knew about the Simanim or not. But it was in a very private way. And we see this Midah of Tzniut throughout her life also in Pshat, that the next source on your sheet is the story of the Trafim, where Rachel steals the Trafim from her father, and he runs after Yaakov and asks for the Trafim back. Now there's a machloket Rishonim about what these trafim were and why Rachel stole them. Meaning Rashi famously thinks that they were Avodah Zarah and that Rachel stole them to distance her father from Avodah Zarah. The Rashbam thinks that they were sort of like a crystal ball. They were some type of trick that you could use, device that you could use to tell the future, and she stole them so that her father wouldn't be able to tell where they had gone. But in any case, for some reason, she felt it very important for the welfare of either her father or her family to steal these trafim. And in the last pasuk in that source, in Lamed Bed, Yaakov says, "Ima asher timsad Elohecha lo yichya neged achinu haker l'chama imadi v'kach l'cha lo yada Yaakov ki Rachel genevatam." So Yaakov says that whoever has the trafim should die because he didn't realize that Rachel had stolen them. So again, we see Rachel in this context as well acting in a way that takes great courage that she felt was necessary for some reason. But in a totally private way that not even Yaakov knows. According to Rashi, this is why she died early, because of what Yaakov says, not knowing that she had stolen them. So you see throughout that Rachel has strength of character, but it's a strength that's always somewhat hidden, that even her greatest moments of virtue and courage are moments that are very private and not open to the public eye. The Gemara connect Rachel's tzniut to the tzniut of Shaul as well. The example of Shaul's tzniut that the Gemara gives is the fact that after Shmuel makes him the king, in Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud, the next source, that he but he keeps it to himself. Meaning the beginning of this perek is where Shmuel anoints him to be the king. And at the end of the perek, when Shaul sees his uncle in Pasuk Yud Dalet, his uncle asks him, you know, what happened? And he said, well, we just went to Shmuel because we couldn't find the atonot, the donkeys. And his uncle says to him, Hagidan Nali Ma Amar Lachem Shmuel, so tell me what Shmuel told you. And Shaul says, he just told me, Ki nimtzu ha'atonot, ve'edivar ha'malucha lo higid. It just told me, you know, that the donkeys were found, we shouldn't worry about it. But he doesn't tell the divar ha'malucha, the fact that Shmuel had also made him a king. So, again, we see this midah of tzniut in this parak as well, but already, very shortly thereafter, in the end of this parak, we see a sort of a hint that Shaul's tzniut, there's something a little off about it, something that's a little twisted in his tzniut, and that at the end of this parak, the next source on your sheet is where when Shmuel does the goral to see who the king is, and Shaul feels that he has to hide. And Hashem says, "Hinehu nechba el hakelim," that Shaul is hiding among the luggage. Which again, you already sort of get a hint right away, even after our first introduction to Shaul, we get a hint right away that his tzniut is a little bit too much. Meaning for the king to be hiding with the luggage is a little bit ridiculous. And we see how this carries out even more so in Perek Tedvav, where he loses the kingship because of not destroying Amalek completely. Throughout this perek, Perek Tetvav, the Mila Mancha of the perek is kol. That the Tanakh keeps contrasting the different kolot, the different voices that Shaul could listen to, and the ones that he chooses to listen to. And right before this source, Shmuel says, when he comes to confront Shaul, he says, "Umek kol hatzon hazeh ba'oznai, b'kol habakar asher anochi shomeya," meaning he mentions the kol of the animals that he hears, that Shaul has not destroyed all of the animals. And throughout, the Tanakh plays with this word kol. In Pasuk Kaf, "Vayomer Shaul al Shmuel asher shamati b'kol Hashem," no, I did listen to the voice of God. And obviously that's not an excuse that Shmuel accepts. He says in Kaf Bet, there's nothing. It's better. Nothing is as important as listening to the voice of God, and in fact, it becomes clear that in Kavdal Shaul says, "Avarti at Pi Hashem." You're right. I didn't listen to the voice of God. But the voice I chose to listen to was the voice of the people. And what we see in this parak is that Shaul becomes very susceptible to public opinion. He's very afraid of his people. He listens to his people's voice over God's voice. And Shmuel reproves him for that in Pasuk Yud Zayin when he says, "Halo im katonata be'inecha, ro shifte yisraelata." Even if you think you're nothing, and you think that you have to like listen to public opinion and what other people think, really you're the ro shifte yisrael, and you have to act as such. And I find a very poignant window into the way that Shaul is thinking is in Pasuk Lamed. When Shaul finally admits Chatati, he says, "You're right, I sinned. Atak habdini na neged ziknei ami v'neged Yisrael. V'shuv imi v'hishtachaveti la'ashem alokecha." He says, "You're right, I sinned. I sinned against God. Okay, I'm going to lose the kingship. I got it. But please, just for now, show me honor in front of my nation. Come with me and I'll bow to them. And I want you to come with me and not embarrass me in front of everyone." Meaning, it's so poignant that's really, he's become so afraid of his nation that he doesn't even seem so troubled by the fact that Chatati LaHashem, he's more concerned with at least saving face. And I think what we see in this parak is that the tzniut of Shaul, which we've seen throughout, I mean, he clearly has a great desire to remain private and to not show off, but it becomes something very different than what it was. This, again, like Shmuel and Korach, the tzniut of Shaul becomes something very different than what it was with Rachel. Meaning with Rachel, the tzniut was a shell, was sort of a covering for a very substantive and courageous personality. And with Shaul, it becomes just a shell. It becomes nothing more than just this sort of overwhelming fear of public opinion. It's not hiding something deeper. It's just what it is. It's just what it looks like. It's just a fear of public displays and a fear of what other people will think, as opposed to just a way to sort of shield something more substantive within. The Abarbanel in the next verse actually says that when he's discussing why Shaul loses the kingship for his sin while David doesn't lose the kingship for his sins, he says, because a king should not be afraid of anyone, But Shaul said, "Ki yareti et ha'am ve'eshma b'kolam." Whereas David, while he committed great sins, was never afraid of other people. And that's a very important trait in leadership, is not to be afraid of your public. One of the most interesting examples I find within the line of Rachel is the personality of Michal. Michal is described very frequently throughout her story as being Michal bat Shaul, meaning it makes it very clear that she's associated with that lineage. It's called a relational epithet when someone is associated with a particular relation in Tanakh. And in the next, we're going to look at a couple of stories that I find very interesting as far as understanding how this Midah of Tzniut, which we already saw in two ways in Rachel and Shaul, comes out in a very different and complex way in the personality of Michal. The next source on your sheet from Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud Tet is the story of where Michal stole the Tefillin. I mean, did not steal the Tefillin, where Michal used the Tefillin to hide that David had run away. So Shaul sends messengers to Beit David to kill him, and David lets Michal, and Michal understands that if David does not run away, he's going to be killed by these messengers. So in Pasuk Yud Bet, the Tored Michal at David ba'ara chalon v'yelech v'yivrach v'yemalit. So Michal lets David out through the window and he runs away. V'atikach Michal et ha'trafim batasem al mita ve'etz kizir ha'izim sama mirashavta v'atachas babaged. So she hides these trafim in the bed, covers them up to pretend that they're David. V'yishlach Shaul malachim lakach at David v'tomer cholehu. So the malachim come to take David and she says, no, he's sick, he's in bed. So that afterwards, Shaul sends the Malachim back to see him. And say, take him out of his bed. What do we care if he's sick? We're about to kill him anyway, right? Ha'alu oto b'amita elai l'hamito. V'yavo ha'malachim v'hinei ha'trafim al-hamita al-kvir ha'izim ne'rashotav. And then so when the Malachim come back, they see that it's really trafim in the bed. V'yomer Shaul al-Michal, lama kacha v'mitani, v'tishalchi et oivi, v'yamalit v'tomer Michal al-Shaul, hu amar elai shalchini lama amitech. So Shaul says to Michal, why did you trick me? And you said, let my enemy get away. And so she says, well, because he said he would kill me otherwise. So clearly it could not be clearer that there are tons of parallels between this story and the story of Rachel with the Tefillin. First of all, there are Tefillin, which don't come up much in Tanakh. Second of all, someone's pretending to be sick. And also this phrase of Lama Kacha Rimitani is very parallel to what Yaakov says of Lama Rimitani. There are a lot of parallels. So the question is why Tanakh wants us to think about that story of Rachel in the context of Michal. And I think the reason is that Rachel and Michal's lives both are complicated by something that they share in common, which is the tragedies of Rachel's life are all due to the fact that she is always torn between conflicting loyalties. She's not the type of person who chooses one side and then that's it. You know, she always is somewhat torn between her father and her sister and her husband. For example, when the whole reason that she got into this relationship of this complicated three-way relationship between herself and Leah and Yaakov is because she wasn't only interested in her own self-interest. Meaning she felt a loyalty to her sister when she was marrying her husband. She felt this loyalty that prevented her from just cutting off that relationship. She shared the simanim out of that torn loyalty to her father, to her husband, and herself and her sister. With the Tefillin as well, we see that she's not able to cut herself off from Lavan, even as she's running away from him. Meaning, especially if you adopt Shitat Rashi, that she was trying to protect Lavan from Avodah Zarah, it means that even as she's running away with Yaakov, she feels a loyalty to Lavan as well. She spends her life really torn between conflicting loyalties. And I think that's very... You know, it makes sense in the context of her personality that she's not someone who just looks out for herself. She's someone who has this need within her of self-sacrifice, as we saw with the Siman, and she's someone who does try to make peace among other people, and as a result, often finds herself pulled between different loyalties. Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay, I didn't give him a kor for the Lubavitch Rebbe. However, I'm saying that I think... So I'm saying this this is an idea that I have based on chat, given that we saw this source that says that she gave the simanim to her sister. We could see that source based on the fact that she didn't want her sister to be embarrassed. So I'm saying what that source tells us is the fact that even as she was getting married to her husband, she felt a loyalty to her sister. Right? Does that make sense to you? Okay, I mean, I think that there is. I think that the fact that she gives the simanim out of loyalty to her sister, which the Gemara said, indicates that she felt loyalty to her sister as she was marrying her husband. And I think also the fact that we see her stealing the trafim from Laban indicates that even as she is, I think that is the source, is chat, is that even as she's running away from Laban, she still feels a connection to Laban, that she takes part of that with her, that she takes part of Laban's house with her, meaning I think the source is chat. So I think in those ways we see that Rachel has these conflicting loyalties between her father, because that she doesn't cut off her father at any point, doesn't cut off her sister at any point, but includes them even within her relationship with her husband. And Michal as well is clearly always a pawn between her husband and her father. The whole reason that David was given to that she was given to David as a wife is because she is the king's daughter. That's an important symbol of leadership. And here as well, in this source, she is having to make the choice between her father and her husband. Meaning, she knows that her father wants to kill her husband, and she has to make a choice between the two of them. Now, in this source, it seems that she does make the choice. It seems that she chooses to side with her husband because she allows him, she helps him escape from her father. At the same time, I think that the reason that Tanakh is giving us all these hints back to the Rachel story is to make us realize that when we look at further excerpts from Tanakh, that in the larger context of her life, the choice is not so clean cut. That in this source, she seems to be choosing her husband over her father by helping him escape from her father. But for example, if we look at the next source in Shmuel Bet Perek Vav, which is the story of when the Aaron comes to Ir David, and Michal bat Shaul nishkafav ad hachalon in the first pasuk, v'tayreh et hamelach David mefazez mecharker lipnei Hashem v'tivez lo b'liba. That as Michal sees the Aaron coming to Ir David, she sees David dancing in front of the Aaron. And the Tanakh refers to her as Michal bat Shaul. In some way, the Tanakh is connecting her to Shaul as she sees him dancing in front of the Aaron. V'tivez lo b'liba. And she feels disgusted. She hates him in her heart. And if we skip down a few more psukim to pasuk kaf, v'yashav David v'varech et beito. David returns to his house, but Teitzei Michal bat Shaul likrat David, but Tomer ma nechbad hayom melech Yisrael, asher nigla hayom le'inei amchot avadav, ki higalot niglot achad harekim. So she says to him, how glorious, how honored is the king of Israel today, who has just revealed himself in front of all of his people. Vayomer David el Michal, lifnei Hashem asher bachar mi me'avicha, umikol beito letzavot oti nagid al am Hashem, al Yisrael v'sichakti lifnei Hashem. V'nikaloti od mizot v'hayti shafal be'inai, v'im ha'malchut asher amart l'imam akaveda. So David says to her, I did this because I was dancing in front of Hashem, who chose me over your father. With that pasuk, David is making it clear that this is not just a domestic dispute between him and Michal, but this is about something much bigger. Meaning when she gets upset by seeing him dance in front of all the people, and he is making it clear that that's not just about you and me. That is also about me and your father. Meaning the model of leadership that I was acting on is the opposite of the model of leadership of your father. That what we saw from Shaul is that he's so afraid of public displays, and that's what we've seen of Beit Rachel throughout. What we see in David here is that he's very much not. He's very much comfortable with being out there in the public eye. And when Michal sees that, she is Michal bat Shaul, meaning she will always see David through the eyes of Beit Shaul and Beit Rachel. And so to her, Bativez lo b'liba, that's just disgusting to her. It doesn't matter the fact that she chose David before, that she thought he was right, and he had the claim to the Malucha, and that we saw in the previous verse that she helps him escape from Shaul. The fact is, when she sees this type of public display, there's something very intrinsic in her that just Bativez lo b'liba, that's not how she does things. Right, that's not how Beit Shaul leads. Whereas when David responds to her that Hashem chose me, not your father, he's letting her know that Hashem chose me and my model of leadership over that of your father. And that's why I'm going to continue in a kaloti od mizot, because this is the model that Hashem chose. And the source ends with Ulamichal bat she'u lo haya la yaled ad yom mota, and she never had another child. And of course this is ambiguous in that it could be that the Tanakh is telling us she never had another child because Hashem rejected her the way he rejected Sheol, or it could just be that she never had another child because the differences between her and David were insurmountable, that they weren't really able to live together based on the differences between them. In addition to being torn, as we see throughout, between her father and her husband, Michal is also torn in another direction as well, which is in the direction of her other husband, Paltiel. We see in the next source that Shaul gave Michal bito, Esha David, Lefalti ben Laish, Asher Migalim. At some point, Shaul, when he was fighting against David, married Michal off to another man, to Palti ben Laish, as sort of a sign against David that he's taking away the king's daughter from him and giving her to someone else. This was a way of fighting against David, taking away some of his legitimacy by not being allowing him to be married to the king's daughter. And later, when David regains the kingship, in the next source, he sends Malachim to Palti to take her to Palti, to take his wife back. And in Pasuk Ketva, Vayishlach Ish Boshet, Vaytechecha Me'im Paltiel Ben Laish. They take her away from Paltiel. And the next pasuk I find so poignant and such a good example of the way that Tanakh characterizes people in just a very few words. It says, Vayelach Ita Isha, Halo Chudacho Achareha Ad Bachurim. Vayomer Elav Abner Leif Shu Vayasho. That her husband Paltiel follows her crying. Halo Chudacho Achareha. He follows her crying until they get to Bachurim, and then Abner, the messenger of David, says, go back, and he goes back. It's just a very sad pasuk in the sense that we don't know anything about Paltiel, but the fact that he's following his wife crying, he has no chance of getting her back. He has no chance of standing against David. Right? It's the king versus him. We don't even know who this guy is. Right? He has no chance of actually getting her back. But the fact that he feels that he walks after her crying nonetheless, even though as soon as Abner tells him, go back, of course he has no choice but to go back, gives us a window into that relationship, that clearly that was a loving relationship. And in this way, it sort of emphasizes the fact that Michal, throughout her life, is a pawn between, it's clear from Tanakh that David did not love Michal ultimately, that she, for him, she was a symbol, being the king's daughter. And these psukim show us the human cost of that. Like, the tragedy of Michal's life is that she is always ultimately a pawn. David wants her because she's the king's daughter. The whole reason she got married to him in the first place was because Shaul was trying to give David legitimacy. Then she was taken away when Shaul was trying to take away legitimacy. But ultimately, there's one person who actually loves her in her life, and that's the person she has to leave, because she spends her whole life being torn between different people who want her for different reasons. And I think that the comparison between her and Rachel in the Trafim story just highlights that commonality between them, that there is something intrinsic in their personality that makes them... I don't think that Leah would have made that choice about the Simana. We see Leah as being much more pragmatic, recognizing her goals, recognizing her reality, sort of going for it. I'm not sure that she would have... I don't actually think she would have given her sister the Simana if she had been in that position. That's just not what we see of her personality. But what we see of Rachel's personality, this nida that the Gemara describes as tzniut, of having the self more hidden away, is that she doesn't choose one person over the other in the same way. And as a result, both she and her descendants in some cases end up spending their lives somewhat torn among different loyalties. Rachel's descendants, I don't want to give the impression at all that Rachel's descendants don't have strength of character. They do. We see many very powerful leaders among Beit Rachel. We see Esther is one, Mordechai, Yosef is a descendant of Rachel. We see many powerful personalities and leaders who are descendants of Rachel. However, they all share one thing in common, which is that they're all leaders in Galut. Right? If you think about it, Yosef, Esther, and Mordechai are all leaders in exile, as opposed to the Malchei Yehuda who come from Leah, who are the kings within Eretz Yisrael of Bnei Yisrael, who are from Leah. And I think there's a reason for that, tied to these midot that we've seen throughout. In fact, if you think about it, Rachel herself is also a leader in Galut. based on the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, which is actually the last source on your sheet, if you want to skip ahead, but the very famous pasuk of Rachel mevakha al banaha, mi'ana li'nachim al banaha ki einenu. The pasuk says that Rachel, because she's buried along the side of the road and not with an Eretz Yisrael, is a sign of nechama to her children as they're in exile. And so in fact, in an ironic way, she not only are her descendants leaders in Galut, she herself becomes a symbol of nechama in Galut as well. But I think the reason that her descendants are very powerful leaders specifically within Galut is because, again, the Jewish identity, what we've said throughout, is that this sort of the sense of self, the courage and the substance and the Jewish identity that sets them apart is something that's very internal and hidden. On the outside, they may be very able to get along with people who are very different or in hostile situations. And just as in Rachel, sort of her strength of character came out only in select moments of crisis, so too we see that with her descendants. Meaning in this next source from Bereshit Lama text, we see that Yosef, everywhere he goes, everyone loves him. Right? Potiphar loves him, and leaves everything. He totally left everything in his hands. And after that, Potiphar loves him, right? And when push comes to shove, he will say, I can't do this because he says, this would be a great sin. Meaning when he's in a moment of crisis, of course, like the sense of the morals of Beit Yaakov are still, of course, very strong within him, but they come out in moments of crisis. Esther as well is known as being someone everyone who saw her liked her, that Hege Shomer HaNashim loved her. That in skipping down two sources, in Esther Perek Bet Tetvav, it says that the Tanakh tells us that when it was her turn to go in front of Ahasuerus, Lo Vikshat Zavar Ki'im Et Asher Yomar Hegei Sris HaMelech Shomer HaNashim. That when it was her turn to go before the king, she didn't take anything except for what Haggai told her to take. Meaning she's someone who gets people like that, right? When you sort of listen to their advice. Meaning she wants to hear, what do you think I should wear, right, when I go in front of the king? And then it immediately follows, and Esther was no saint queen, anyone who saw her liked her. Which I think is sort of comparing, you know, making it clear that she gets along very well with other people in that type of a way. Then she goes in front of the king in Pasuk Yud Zayin, and he loves her. And then the episode finishes up with Ein Esther Magedet Muladata Ve'etama Ka'asher Tziva Aleha Mordechai Ve'etmanar Mordechai Esther Osa Ka'asher Haita Ba'amnel Ito. Again, she doesn't tell who she is, really. She's someone who can get along very well with others. She's very pleasing externally. She knows how to take other people's advice. She's beautiful. But she doesn't tell who she really is. It's always hidden. Until the next source, when push really comes to shove, when the Jewish people are in danger, of course she does. The point is, she waits until the moment when it's absolutely necessary. In fact, we see this ability to lead in hostile situations and sort of to get along well with a wide range of people and only reveal one's sort of inner self when it becomes necessary. In the fact that all of the descendants of Rachel are known for being very beautiful, very physically beautiful, which is in line with this idea of being very sort of externally pleasing, being someone that everyone likes to be around. In the very first time that we're introduced to Leah and Rachel, in Bereshit Perek Kaf Tet, Ve'eni Leah Rakot, but Rachel Haita Yifat Toar Yifat Maret. They're juxtaposed and contrasted in that while Leah is not described as being beautiful, Rachel is. Again, in the next source, that Shaul is described as Bakur V'Tov, Ve'ein Ish Mi Bnei Yisrael Tov Mimenu Mishech V'Mamala Gavoa Mikol Ha'am. Shaul is also described as being extremely physically beautiful. Esther, of course, is also described as being extremely physically beautiful. This is in contrast to the descendants of Leah, who we already saw, Leah, Ene Leah Rakot. And while David, in the next source, is seen as being, you know, it does say that he was Yafei Ra'i, at the same time, he is described as being very small. It says, and Hashem even introduces, when he says that David is going to be the king, he says, Al tabit al narehu, ve'al gavoa komato. Like, don't look at the externals of a person. That's the way that he introduces his appointment of David to king. And he is stressed as being a katan. And then when Goliath sees him, in Perek Yud Zayin, ve'yabeit ha'plishti, ve'yira et David, ve'yivzevehu. Rav Zehu, ki haya na'ar ba'admoni im yafei mareh. And he was attractive, he was like yafei mareh, but at the same time, he was not impressive physically. He was not formidable physically. I think this sort of line of the physical appearance of people as well goes along with these different models of leadership in the line of Rachel and the line of Leah. The Leah line of being someone who's very assertive and proactive is chosen as being the model of leadership for Jews in Eretz Yisrael. Now, it's also interesting to note, Nechama Leibowitz pointed out, the Chazal often give most people in Tanakh nicknames based on who they were. Moshe Rabbeinu, Abraham Avinu, Aaron HaKohen. There are only two people in Tanakh whom Chazal give nicknames to based not on what they did, what their role was as a Kohen or a teacher or a forefather, but based on sort of who they were, on their midot. And those two people are Yosef and Mordechai. They're both called Yosef HaTzadik and Mordechai HaTzadik. Nechama Leibowitz suggests that the reason that they are considered tzaddikim, I mean, obviously all of Abraham was also a tzaddik, which was also but the reason that Chazal referred to them as tzaddikim is because they had a particular type of nisayon. Both of them had a nisayon that goes on every single day. A nisayon that wasn't about just getting up one morning and doing the akeda, but a nisayon that required them to stand up to people who were trying to sort of beat them down every day. If we look in the next couple of sources, that with Eshet Potiphar, in Bereshit Perek Lamed Tet, Pasuk Yud, the Torah says, "Vayhi kedabra al Yosef yom yom, b'lo shama eleha, lishkad atzla liyotima." Every day, Eshet Potiphar would try to seduce Yosef. And again, with the next source in Esther, every day, in Pasuk Dalet, "Vayhi ka'amram elav yom yom, b'lo shama aleihem, v'yagidu lahaman lirot hayamdu divrei Mordechai." Right? That every day, they tried to get Mordechai to bow to Haman. Every day, he said no. I think, again, that's associated with this mitzvah of Esther, that sort of inner fortitude and endurance of being able to get along in a hostile situation, being able to even to get along with other people in a hostile situation without losing the inner identity that is somewhat hidden from view. So and if you think of the nisyonot of Rachel, it was very similar. The nisyon that she faced of living in this marriage that was, you know, very complicated by the fact of Leah being involved as well. That was also the type of nisayon that goes on every day. And I think that's very related to the way that Chazal see tzniut, the tzniut of Rachel. I think that overall, what this helps us do is understand the way that, first of all, give us insight into how the mitzvot of Rachel and Leah travel down through the generations and their descendants, and how actually all of the leaders in Tanakh can be fit into one of these two models, of the Leah model or the Rachel model. Meaning the leaders in Galut, such as Esther and Mordechai and Yosef, follow this particular model of Rachel's midot, whereas the Malka Yehuda are much more open and have much more of a public presence. And in fact, even the people who choose to join the Beit Leah demonstrate the same midot of Beit Leah. For example, when Tamar chooses to seduce Yehuda by dressing up as a prostitute, she also does something in somewhat along those lines of being willing to even demean herself in order to join this family of Leah, which is what we've seen Leah do as well, that she's willing even to do things that make her uncomfortable, that it could be seen as somewhat demeaning in order to accomplish her goals. So I think it is just interesting to be able to see Tanakh as falling, the leaders in Tanakh, as falling into one of these two. And also, in a sort of way, I think it gives a comforting take on mortality, in the sense that we see that, first of all, Rachel and Leah themselves accomplished things in death that they were never able to accomplish in life. That they, if you think about it, Rachel spent her whole life wanting to be a mother, right? And the way she's buried reflects that. She's buried on the path where she can be a sign of nechama to her children. Rachel nevata al beneha. Leah spent her whole life wanting to be Yaakov's wife. And she is consequently buried in Maran HaMachpelah next to Yaakov. And not only that, but even their children and descendants throughout the centuries carry on midot that they acted on in their lives and take those midot even to new levels. So I think thinking about even that as far as not only Tanakh, but life in general, is to me an interesting concept that people's goals and midot don't necessarily end with their deaths. But in particular, as far as applying it to Tanakh, I think that we can really see that this gives us sort of a big picture approach to understanding the different models of leadership in Tanakh and how ultimately they really are all derived from the Midot of Rachel and Leah in the beginning.